Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It was one of the more interesting consequences of globalization. For years, as China boomed, it needed all the plastic and paper it could get its hands on to make and package the products it was selling to the world. The world, and notably the United States, had millions of tons of plastic and paper waste to get rid of, so China bought all of that recyclable stuff. But last year, China said it wouldn't take the bulk of the world's recycling anymore. Now, this country's whole waste management and recycling system is groaning under a mountain of plastic. So what are local municipalities doing? Some are landfilling it, some burning it, some simply not picking it up anymore. This hour on Point, the future of recycling. And you can join us. Are you still putting out the special bins onto your sidewalks once a week? Are you sure it's not ending up in a landfill or an incinerator? Has your town changed its rules on recycling? I mean, most of us grew up with the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle. Two of those still work. But are there new opportunities now that that third R may no longer be an option? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today in Washington with David Biederman. He's executive director of the Solid Waste Association of North America, a nonprofit made up of municipalities and solid waste companies. David Biederman, welcome to the program.
Hello, Meghna. Great to be here.
So give us the big picture here, first of all. How much has the ability or the cost of towns and municipalities across the country changed for recycling in the past year or two?
So in late 2017, when China announced that it would be restricting imports of waste and scrap from not just the United States but throughout the world, it started to have an impact on the amount of revenue that local governments and our private sector partners were able to get for that material because the supply and demand balance had been affected. And then in early 2018, China did two things. They imposed a ban on certain types of plastic being imported into the country, and they also imposed a ban on what we call mixed paper. That's the mix of paper that comes out of residential households like food cartons and loose paper and junk mail, and that material no longer is allowed to be shipped to China. Other material can be shipped to China, such as old cardboard containers, which we all get many of as a result of Amazon delivering to our house all the time, or newspapers, and other types of material. But that material needs to satisfy a very stringent contamination standard. And many American and Canadian facilities have trouble meeting that standard. And so we've been looking for, and in most cases, finding new markets for the material.
So, so much to dig into here, David. But just to give people a sense as to how important China was to the global recycling market, I'm seeing numbers here from 2016 that China was importing at that time 7 million tons of recyclable waste from around the world. Almost 10% of that, 700,000 tons, came from the United States. So it was critical in our global recycling stream here. Are there any other nations that have been willing to step up, or are we kind of permanently losing the opportunity or the ability to send our trash elsewhere?
So foreign markets have played an increasingly important role for American recycling, as the amount of material that Americans recycle has increased over the last 20 or 25 years. We recycle about 35% of the municipal solid waste that's generated in the United States. And we export, historically, over the last few years, about a third of it. So we generate about 67 million tons and we export about 22 million tons. And it's true, the majority of that material, primarily paper and plastic, was going either to China directly or to Hong Kong and then from Hong Kong into China. And during 2018, as China began to impose its restrictions, we began to see significantly higher amounts of scrap and recyclables going to other Asian destinations such as Indonesia, India, Vietnam, and Malaysia. But many of those countries have been flooded by material and are starting to impose their own restrictions. And so at the end of the day, I think we need to increase and expand our domestic American infrastructure for handling recycling. And I know we're going to talk about this. Mm-hmm. We need to educate Americans on how to recycle properly and reduce the level of what we call contamination in the blue bin.
So I definitely want to talk to you about that because, you know, even though I grew up thinking that I knew everything there was to know about recycling, it's a little confusing these days. But before we get to that, you know, the United States has been working very hard for more than a generation now to get people in the habit of recycling. I mean, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from the city of Murfreesboro, Tennessee. They put out a public service announcement just in 2017 to encourage kids to recycle in Rutherford County.
The city and county solid waste departments are working together to find the best plan for our residents and their trash. No matter what plan they come up with, there is one thing that has to happen: recycling. And you can start that today.
So, David Biederman, I'm wondering if you think that this sort of change in the global recycling system couldn't have come at a worse time, because it seems to have happened right as the United States is really getting much better at, or Americans are getting much better at, not throwing so much stuff in the trash.
Well, there's never a good time for your largest export customer to decide it no longer wants to receive much of your material. But the good news here is that in response to this situation, and it's a national problem, you're seeing local governments, state governments, private companies all getting together and discussing the issue, discussing the problem of contamination. We see a lot of investment taking place in the United States in, for example, reopening closed paper mills and repurposing them to take recycled paper. We're seeing companies like Pratt Industries build new facilities in Ohio. And so down the line, 3-4 years from now, I really do think we're going to have much more robust domestic capacity to handle our recyclables.
So never let a good crisis go to waste, right? There's an opportunity here. David Biederman, stand by for just a moment, because we wanted to sort of touch down in a place that's dealing with these increased costs of recycling and what they're doing about it. So let's go to Franklin, New Hampshire. We're joined by Tony Giunta. He is the mayor of the town of Franklin and director of project development for Nobis, an environmental and engineering consultancy. Mayor Giunta, welcome to On Point.
Hi, a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So I've been reading about sort of the challenges that Franklin has been facing regarding its recycling, and that at this point in time, is Franklin sending what once was recycled to the incinerator?
Yes, it is. It's a waste-to-energy plant, so a little bit better than just going to incineration, actually getting some return on it via electricity production. But nonetheless, it's not what we wanted and intended to do with our recyclables.
Yeah. I mean, since 2010, you've offered curbside recycling in Franklin, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And at that point in time, it was actually making a little bit of money, or at least breaking even on being able to sell that recycling off?
It was a great way to go about looking out for our taxpayers, because at that time we were actually getting paid for recyclables. We were making about $6 a ton for every ton of recyclables that we were sending away to the recycler. That dynamic has shifted dramatically, and it has caused a real problem for us in our budget and for our taxpayers, because now it's gone from being paid for recyclables to now actually having to pay for them. And it's gone from the $6 we were getting to $50 to send away to today over $120 to send our recyclables for recycling.
Wow. So just to reiterate, you were getting paid a little bit before, and now in order to do the recycling, you have to pay $125 a ton. Or the $68 to incinerate it, so it's cheaper for you to burn it.
It is. Yes, it is. And so essentially at the end of the day, we don't have a huge budget where we can compensate for that tremendous difference. So we are doing what is best and what can be accepted by our taxpayers, and we're sending it all for trash.
Yeah. So, I mean, this has got to be an unhappy situation because, in burning plastics especially, that's releasing all sorts of toxins into the air, right?
It is. And not only that, but I was listening also to David, and when you were talking about doing the right thing and all of these public service announcements, and we've gotten everybody to feel really good about doing the right thing for the environment. In this particular case, it was economically a good thing to do as well. And that tremendous shift has really impacted people in the community. They want to continue to do the right thing. They also realize they want to be able to live in their homes and pay their taxes. So they realize that we have to do the right thing, too, and do the right thing economically.
Mm. So David Biederman was also saying that there could be a potential opportunity here. Do you see that? Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel with this new recycling challenge?
I hesitate because I've been doing this for 30 years, and I have seen these cycles come and go. And there have been great times for recycling, and then all of a sudden there is a crash. And in this particular case, it's China this time around. But in the past, it's been something different. And it is very, very difficult to predict this market. I agreed with the conversation and David saying, we have to solve this more looking at it from a domestic perspective. If we continue to go with China or some big international buyer of our recyclables, and we put all of our eggs in that basket, look what happens when they change the rules. Everything crashes, and you end up with municipalities like ours struggling, because now realize that back in 2010, we made decisions for the next 20 years based on the market that was established then. And so we are paying for that poor decision back in 2010 when everything looked really rosy. But we should have known, because you remember the old saying, those who don't learn from the past are destined to repeat it. And these markets have been up and down, and you really have to have a backup plan and probably a second backup plan. But yes, in direct answer to your question, there is another opportunity, but I think that opportunity resides domestically, not internationally.
Well, Mayor Tony Giunta, he's the mayor of Franklin, New Hampshire, and director of the project development for Nobis, an environmental and engineering consultancy. Mayor Giunta, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We are talking about the difficulty that municipalities across the United States are having in the past year or two with recycling, about where to send it. So sometimes they're burning it, like you heard is happening in Franklin, New Hampshire. Sometimes they're landfilling it. Sometimes they're just not picking it up. Have you seen changes where you live in terms of what you can recycle? Are you confident it's being recycled? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the challenge that municipalities across the United States have been facing over the past year or two regarding where to send their recycling. It's suddenly become a lot more expensive because China has stopped taking the bulk of U.S. recycling materials. So some municipalities are burning it, some are landfilling it, some simply aren't picking it up anymore. And we want to hear from you if you've seen changes in what you can put in those bins that you put out on the street once a week. I'm joined today by David Biederman. He's executive director of the Solid Waste Association of North America. And joining us now as well is Jenna Jambeck. She's with us from Athens, Georgia. She's professor in the University of Georgia's College of Engineering, an expert in waste and recycling, and co-creator of the Marine Debris Tracker app, which tracks marine debris. Professor Jambeck, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Glad to be here.
So I want to play just a quick piece of tape for both you and David Biederman here, because David, in the previous segment, was talking about the challenges of contaminants in our recycling streams here. So this is Michael Taylor. He's director of recycling operations for the Bureau of Solid Waste Management in Baltimore, Maryland. And he talked to the Baltimore Sun last June about these challenges.
The biggest issue that we have at the recycling facilities today is really the material that shouldn't be placed in the recycling container in the first place. We refer to that as wishful recycling. A material a resident may see on the package that there is a recycling symbol on it and presume that that material should go into the recycling bin. For us, however, those materials present themselves as contaminants. It's a trash material that we have to spend the time to separate out from the real recycling that we're trying to accomplish.
That's Michael Taylor, Director of Recycling Operations for the Bureau of Solid Waste Management in Baltimore. So, Professor Jambeck, let me turn to you first, because when he said that, you know, consumers look at the recycling symbol on a package and presume they can just throw it in their blue bin, I'm one of those consumers. I know maybe there's certain numbers I can't do, but why is it that we can't just presume that anymore?
Well, it's exactly as you just said. You said you look at some of the numbers. So not all of the, you know, the plastics are the same resin, and they need to be processed separately because they all have different characteristics in terms of their melt points and you know, processing into new materials. So that's why some of them can be taken and some of them can't, and it all depends upon the economic markets and for your specific community where, you know, if they can send that off, if it's economical.
Mm-hmm. And David Biederman, has this problem become worse as some communities have been able to move to single-stream recycling?
Certainly the move to single stream, although it expanded what people were throwing away in their recycling bin, it increased contamination, where we now have a lot of wishful recyclers where something has plastic in it, so they put it in the blue bin. And they put a remarkable array of things in those blue bins, hoses, Christmas lights, batteries, bowling balls, and a variety of other things.
Bowling balls? You've seen bowling balls in those blue bins?
So I love to point out bowling balls, both because I like to bowl, but also because Waste Management, the largest solid waste company in the United States, has apparently determined that hundreds of bowling balls are coming through their recycling facilities. And if people are recycling bowling balls, it does make me question whether we're educating people properly about what does truly go in the blue bin and what isn't recyclable in curbside recycling. And it's important to distinguish between curbside recycling, where you put out a bin, and communities that still offer the opportunity to drop off material at a convenience center, such as continues to take place in Franklin, New Hampshire, where they eliminated curbside but still allow people to drop off glass, metal, and paper, and I presume plastic, but I'm not certain about that, at their facility.
Yeah. So, Jenna Jambeck, bowling balls is quite an entertaining one, but apparently a big problem. What are the other sort of big offenders? I think people are often confused by food, like or plastics, especially that have some food waste on them. Should we be like washing with soap and water everything that's touched food?
Definitely rinsing out, because food residue has an impact, and that's especially on paper. So lots of people ask about pizza boxes, and if there's a lot of grease on the cardboard part itself, you don't want to recycle that, but you can take off the top where it's not greasy and recycle that in communities that can take that material. So food waste and residual for sure on items. And I think things that just, yeah, I mean, basically if it is plastic, then people think that they can put it in. But it definitely is about seeing the recyclable symbol, knowing what your community takes, which is not always an easy thing to know. I mean, sometimes that information is buried on websites or PDF mm-hmm. files that are, you know, a link somewhere. And so it's actually not always easy. Even me traveling around the U.S., because every community is different, I don't always know.
I'm seeing now also some things like black plastic, you know, the kind that you commonly find in takeout containers, for example, the bottom of the takeout container with the clear plastic lid on top, that for some municipalities aren't taking those anymore because they, even if you clean them, the black plastic is a contaminant. Is that right?
Well, that's because basically it's like mixing paint, right? Because if it's black, it has the pigments already in there, then the recycled material can be nothing but black, because it basically darkens it. And so it's a challenge for recycling, because then you have less outputs for when that material is mixed together. One example from Norway, for PET bottle-to-bottle recycling, they only allow clear and a little bit of blue bottles to be produced, because then they can do bottle-to-bottle recycling into these clear bottles every time. So they limit, like, the pigments that can be put in them.
Well, David Biederman, forgive me for sounding somewhat naive. I'll admit I'm being deliberately naive here. Why is it so hard to separate things like black plastic out? What is it about how we process the recycling that makes the contaminant so easily able to contaminate entire batches of recycling?
So what's happening is that the recycling stream is evolving and evolving quickly. And the private sector and local governments are having trouble keeping up with all the changes in material. So it's not just black plastic. It's flexible packaging. We've gone from a universe where everybody got their laundry detergent in large plastic jugs that were very recyclable. And now that many people are purchasing their laundry detergent in these pouches that are flexible, and people don't know exactly what to do with that flexible packaging. And they kind of many of them are throwing it into the blue bin thinking it's recyclable. We need to continue to invest in the recycling infrastructure. But right now, when the revenue associated with recycling is down by 40 to 50%, and the cost of processing material has risen as local governments and the private sector add people to sort material, buy new machines, and invest in technology, their costs are going up at the same time. So that's why we have this challenge right now in the United States in terms of getting recycling right.
Right. So we're going to talk about what we could do to face those challenges. But Professor Jambeck, I do want to ask you, if we're having this sudden shift in how much we can recycle and instead incinerating some of it, landfilling other portions of it, I mean, there have got to be environmental impacts to this, right? I was talking earlier with the mayor of Franklin, New Hampshire. Like, you're just sending a lot of toxins in the air when you're burning plastics, or you know, we didn't want to put more stuff into the landfill.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why people are motivated to recycle as much as they can, right? Because they don't want it to go into those other situations. We have engineered these facilities and, you know, they're monitored by our USEPA. And so in terms of how we manage it here, you know, some of those trade-offs, certainly recycling has greenhouse gas savings and various good environmental impacts based upon doing that. But we have robust facilities otherwise for disposal and management here. I think the environmental implications globally are something that need to be discussed in terms of when we were exporting this material, where it was being processed around the world. It was typically high-income countries exporting to lower-income countries, and the pollution that we saw from the actual recycling globally was having impacts on human health and the environment that way as well. So I think we need to just think about all of those trade-offs.
Right. And in fact, on that exact point, we have this comment on our website from HelloKitty0580, who says, "The global south won't take our trash anymore, so this is the end of recycling? That's a ridiculous premise," Hello Kitty says. And by the way, Hello Kitty, we ask these questions to get your attention, and I think we did. So let's hear what she has to say. Hello, or he, or they. Hello Kitty says, "This isn't the end of recycling. If anything, this is a signifier that we need to get serious about our waste, since we really aren't serious about it before. We really weren't serious about it before. Offshoring our trash to other countries was never a viable solution in the first place." So let's go to the phones. Let's go to Charlie, who's calling from New Orleans. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well, although I'm a little disheartened. I was so proud of my family because we started composting and recycling. We had almost no trash, and now I'm like, maybe we're generating as much trash as we were before.
Well, you're probably not generating as much as New Orleans post Mardi Gras. Last year, we had about 950 tons of trash alone just from the holiday. So we definitely contribute a lot. But I'm calling to kind of comment in regards to not only just New Orleans, but a lot of cities that have recycling programs don't really recycle. It's kind of disheartening to see when you put out your recycling bins, the trash companies come by and they don't even sort out the materials. And what a lot of people in New Orleans and other cities are finding that, you know, the recyclable materials are just going directly into the trash. So it's kind of counterproductive. You know, I want to recycle. Everybody wants to recycle. But what's the point if the proper procedures isn't being followed and those recyclable materials are just ending up in the trash?
Yeah, Charlie, good point. And thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Claire, who's calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Claire, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm so happy to be on the air. I work for 15 towns in Massachusetts on the South Shore, and this is very disheartening to hear that some towns are considering this. Certainly none of my towns are doing it. We know that it's short-sighted to consider eliminating recycling programs. We don't have enough disposal capacity in our state, and it's shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a recycling problem. It's a consuming problem. We have too much stuff, and we need to put things in the right place and reduce as much as possible. The problem is that people, as David Biederman and others have said, are not putting the right things in the recycling. And we are working really hard with the Mass DEP supporting us to inform our residents and enforce mm-hmm. about what can and can't go in. Plastic bags have caused a huge problem, food waste, tanglers. So if we can get that under control, we will have a robust recycling program, and hopefully we'll be able to engage industry, which is providing us with all these wonderful disposable products that are clogging up our recycling and waste streams. And brand owners are starting to step up and try to think about what will happen to their materials at the end of their life, and we need them to be better partners in that, as well as in sharing some of the costs.
Right. Well, Claire, I'm going to take it back from you there, but thank you so very much. Jenna Jambeck, it's interesting because, you know, we heard from the director of a regional recycling cooperative across 15 towns just in Massachusetts. What advice would you give to municipalities on sort of how to handle the new challenges with recycling?
Yeah. Well, I think Claire made a great point about waste reduction. So in the U.S., we produce 2 to 3 times as much waste per person as to many of those countries where we were exporting to. And I also really think she made a good point about the fact that, you know, really the burden of this management has fallen on the communities, and they just have to react to whatever is made and whatever ends up in the waste stream. And that's been a real challenge because as products and materials have been designed historically, no one's really thought about the end of their life or the end of their cycle to make them more recyclable. And I think that's where we need to see a shift. So I really would like to see more of this upstream interaction with municipalities and folks in the waste management industry where we can proactively address these issues.
Yeah. Well, David Biederman, let's get to the issue of what can we do technologically here in the United States, because earlier in the program we were talking about if there's an opportunity, it has to be a domestic one here, right? I mean, for years, China had the demand for these materials because they were converting them into new products, but also the cheap labor. We've got a comment here on Facebook that says from Sarah Brown DeVost. She's saying it's shocking that the U.S. doesn't have the brain power, manpower, and or willpower to figure out how to recycle plastic. So what are some of the ideas out there about how to deal with all of this plastic that we suddenly can't send away?
Well, what we are seeing is a number of the manufacturers of containers and plastic manufacturers are making investments in technology to recycle that material and are committing funds to help local governments educate their consumers, educate their citizens on how to recycle properly. Just this morning, for example, Coca-Cola announced a grant in the city of Atlanta that's going to help the city of Atlanta clean up its contamination levels. Certainly, technology has an important role to play. We're seeing robotics being introduced into recycling facilities. Artificial intelligence is being tested in a number of facilities. But at the end of the day, the material isn't going to be a sellable commodity if Americans continue to put the wrong stuff in the blue bin. It isn't cheap to process recyclable material. The reason Franklin made the decision it made, and I candidly disagree with it, is because it costs more for them to recycle than it does to send the material to waste to energy. So we need to be upfront with our citizens that recycling isn't free. We need to invest in technology. This is a national problem, and I think the federal government should play a bigger role here in supporting recycling nationally. And I do think that between the federal government, the private sector, investing in new capacity – several years out, we're going to be in a much better balance between supply and demand, with much more of our material being managed domestically. And many of the communities that are unfortunately restricting their recycling or narrowing their recycling programs, expanding them back again to collect a wider variety of material.
I see. So Jenna Jambeck, I mean, you're the engineer here, so I'm going to ask you when we come back from a quick break about some of technological possibilities. But what do you think about David Biederman and what he says about we just won't be able to sell it because people are still putting the wrong stuff into the streams?
Well, I mean, part of it is that. I mean, you can have lots of technology and the way the single-stream MRFs were designed to separate materials, they were well designed. But, yeah, if you have, you know, all the wrong stuff coming in, that remains the challenge.
Well, Jenna Jambeck and David Biederman, stand by. We're talking about the challenge, the difficulty that municipalities in the United States are facing now because China stop taking the bulk of our recycling. It's become more expensive to recycle, so towns are sometimes burning it, sometimes landfilling it, sometimes just not picking it up. Have you seen that change where you are, and what should we do about it? We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about how it's harder to recycle these days. Maybe not for you as you throw your recycling into a recycling bin, but for municipalities across the United States. And here's why. Here's Portland native Satish Palshikar speaking to NPR's Cassandra Profita in 2017 after his local recycling facility declined to take his plastic trash.
There was no plastic recycling. And the fellow said, well, we don't take plastic anymore. It should go in a trash.
Without buyers in China, their recycling company doesn't know what to do with all that plastic. So they stopped taking it. And a lot of companies are in the same boat.
That's from Portland in 2017. I'm joined today by David Biederman. He's executive director of the Solid Waste Association of North America. And by Jenna Jambeck, professor in the University of Georgia's College of Engineering and an expert in waste and recycling. So, Professor Jambeck, I want to talk with you about sort of where technological solutions can take us. Because, yes, I've heard you both loud and clear about educating people about what to put and what not to put in those recycling streams. But full disclosure here, my undergraduate degree from 100 years ago is actually in environmental engineering and environmental science. And I remember one day I took a trip to a local recycling processing facility. And, you know, the trucks would come in and dump the recycling on conveyor belts. And then one of the first things I saw and that stayed with me was the image of workers hand-picking out the contaminants from the recycling stream. Now, obviously, not a really efficient way to do it. So aren't there possibilities for technology, for robotics, to help make the streams cleaner and therefore easier and better to recycle?
That's so great that you went to the facility. I think that helps educate a lot of folks on what actually happens. So the hand picking actually is fairly efficient. I mean, people really can – the image recognition can be a little challenging, but it's getting better. It is getting better. And robotics are getting expanded. You heard David refer to both that and artificial intelligence.
Right.
You know, with machine learning, you know, there can be algorithms that see, you know, these contaminants. But I think we still have this problem. There's a huge variety of things ending up in that stream. And so, you know, the human brain really can spot those better. I also, you know, I think this is a combination of kind of thinking about these upstream changes that we can do so that the waste stream is easier to process, and then changing our processing systems to meet what the waste stream is like. And I think it's going to be a combination of both of those coming together in some of these engineering solutions.
I see. Now, what about, since so many more and more places are actually incinerating their plastic recycling, are there ways to burn it that are less polluting?
Well, you know, there's other thermal treatment, we call it. And so there's both gasification and pyrolysis. And a lot of folks are looking at converting plastics to fuel, which you can do through both of those processes. There are chemical recycling, which is depolymerization. Of course, these are polymers that make up the plastic. And if you can get it back to a monomer through a chemical process, then you can use those monomers again. And some of the additives and contamination that we're talking about that impacts more of a mechanical recycling process can be is not as much of an issue in some of these other processes, but they do require a consistent stream, and so partly sort of hardwiring the infrastructure to feed one of these systems can be problematic as well, because again the waste stream is so variable.
So I was just about to ask you then, how widespread are these other options, these other less polluting incineration methods?
Most of these facilities are at industrial units that sort of have a consistent feedstock. So I'm thinking of some that I know of that, and I don't even know if they're still operating, like in the carpet industry within Georgia where I am. I do know a facility tried to open in Massachusetts. Historically, I used to be at the University of New Hampshire, and when I was there, there was a gasification facility that tried to open that did not make it. They traditionally have been a bit more expensive and just harder to operate.
Yeah. David Biederman, then, are these some of the examples that you're thinking about when we think about the future domestic solutions to this recycling problem?
Absolutely. With regard to plastic in particular, there is a lot of investment taking place in polymer-level recycling, in converting plastic into fuel. And it takes time to site these facilities, but there's a lot of interest in doing so. The plastic manufacturers realize they have a target on their back. Plastic in the oceans in particular has become a global issue and a global problem. And it affects the equity of the brand if I don't want to mention any particular companies, but if a company is being perceived as being contributing to a global environmental problem, they're going to invest money in solving it. We're seeing some of that activity taking place in the United States. SWANA is engaged with these organizations and talking to them about moving quicker, about their responsibility, as Jenna said, for designing for the end of life of the material. And if I can just make one comment, the material that is going to waste-to-energy facilities, such as in Franklin, New Hampshire, as Jenna said, these facilities are highly regulated, highly technologically oriented, and they really bear no resemblance to the types of mass burn incineration that was, you know, potentially leading to air emissions that caused problems back in the 1980s and 1990s.
Right. Point taken on that, and I'm glad you reiterated what Professor Jambeck said. But, you know, on the other hand, we also still just want to reduce the amount of waste we're generating to begin with so that there's less that we're sending to incineration facilities. I mean, we've got a lot of comments coming in here. For example, Steve Langdon on our Facebook page says, I've seen an increase in the amount of plastic packaging over the past several years. My daughter bought a cookie for her daughter. It was packaged in a little plastic box. And I think we could have our packaging if we set our minds to it. And Annette Blum says, I try to recycle, but it's confusing and changes from locality to locality. I'm at the point where I hate plastic, but we are surrounded by it. I especially despise the plastic packaging that's hard to cut through, even with scissors. Annette, I'm right there with you. Let's go to the phones. Rebecca is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've managed MRF's recycling facilities and pretty much could reiterate most of what's been said today. My biggest attribution of the problem was to the switch over to single stream. And when it was marketed in our community, it basically came out and said, oh, put all your recyclables into one bin. Well, the market interpreted that as put everything in the one bin.
Yeah, it was absolutely the miracle move, right? I completely understand, Rebecca. Go ahead.
And so the end result was just incredible. The amount of damage that this equipment sustained from bowling balls and plastic and hoses and chains, lawnmowers coming through the system. And that causes a plant to go down, and you have workers standing around not working while you're trying to repair the equipment. But I think my biggest complaint about the move to single stream was, you know, it was money motivated. A lot of communities made lots of money selling garbage to Asia, and now they're reaping the ill winds of that because it brought a lot of communities adopted the single stream system when they probably shouldn't have.
Right. Well, Rebecca, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. Once again, Rebecca reiterating a point we heard earlier, that just long-term, the idea of sending our trash to other countries probably wasn't a very viable one. But also lawnmowers ending up in recycling, people will do anything, I guess. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm sort of a recycling skeptic. This came about to me probably 20 years ago when I was driving through the South and saw all these pulp tree plantations and realizing that, you know, by recycling our newspapers, we weren't saving the redwoods. We were replacing a very renewable resource. And then I think it's probably an infamous article in the recycling community that John Tierney wrote in the New York Times, which I've never really seen refuted, but I would rather see pickups of the things that make our landfills toxic, like batteries and electronics, instead of putting all this energy into something that's as the problem with Chinese shows, it's just not working. The one exception to this is aluminum, which clearly there is a market for, because it does save waste. But yeah. You know, you have people in the Southwest desert washing out a glass bottle to put in the recycling bin using water, and that glass bottle replaces sand in glass production,
right.
which is not. I think we were sort of sold a bill of goods about recycling, and part of which is that landfills are filling up, whereas particularly if we could go across state lines, there's plenty of room.
So Michael, I'm going to take it back from you there, because I really appreciate your call, because you're getting us to a point that we must discuss. And Michael, thank you so much. Jenna Jambeck, Michael's bringing a couple of good points, so let's break them down a little bit. One is landfill space. Is there adequate landfill space for a big pulse over several years of more formally recyclable materials?
That really depends upon where you are. I think you heard, tipping fees are very high in the New England area in Massachusetts. And actually, for years, a lot of waste from New England has been shipped down to the Southeast, where I'm at. And so maybe within the U.S. as a whole, but not in particular areas, for sure.
Okay.
There's challenges related to that.
Well, I mean, there's also the argument that we need to finally bear the true cost of our consumption. And if that is things get more expensive to throw away, that's how it may be. But what about what Michael also said about if we're looking at overall environmental impact, maybe we ought to focus on the things that truly contaminate or are bad for make landfills especially dangerous places. He was talking about batteries, electronics, chemicals. Focus on that rather than worrying about the recycling.
I think that is an interesting point. And I mean, many communities do that. We have a great center for hard to recycle materials here. It is a drop-off center, but it takes all of those materials, and it should be a focus as well. I don't know how much, it should take away from the other. I think sort of the point, I think your point about waste reduction in the first place is very well taken for much of this material. I think getting creative about how we can get products to people without packaging, some of the other points being made about packaging that's hard to open or feeling like it's unnecessary packaging for marketing or mm-hmm. maybe other reasons. I think there's this upstream change that sort of needs to happen, and that will facilitate facilitate an easy to recycle system like aluminum, which he referred to as a good system. So, but yeah, getting some of those contaminants out from the landfill is a good practice for a community as well.
Well, about upstream solutions, let's go to Carmen, who's calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. I think Carmen might have an idea on that front. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it would be an interesting idea if the manufacturers were actually responsible for the end of life or recycling or destruction of the actual shipping of the product or the packaging. As a consumer, I don't get the option of picking the packaging that my products come in, and I don't imagine that a shampoo company or a razor blade company will necessarily become an expert in recycling. But I think if they were responsible for the end of life of the packaging, they would be more conscientious and how they package and in finding a facility or company that actually could recycle responsibly. And I think they would look at reducing the packaging and making it all more recyclable if it was their responsibility rather than always the consumers who doesn't have the option of picking that packaging.
Yeah. Carmen, thank you so much for your call. I love the out-of-the-box thinking on that. David Biederman, what do you think?
So Carmen raises a point that's being discussed in many state capitals and across the United States. The concept of product stewardship, that the people who make the products are responsible for them, or as it's sometimes phrased, EPR, which stands for Extended Producer Responsibility, which imposes on the manufacturers of materials the requirement to manage them. We do that with certain toxic type of materials on a state-by-state basis. We don't have a national program around light bulbs or certain automotive things that have mercury in them, but certain states have passed laws that require that those materials to be taken back in certain ways, and that is funded by the manufacturers. It is something that is more popular in Canada and Europe than it is in the United States. But just 2 weeks ago at a SWANA conference, we had a healthy debate on this topic, and I think it's going to be part of the discussion going forward.
Mm. So we've just got a couple minutes left to go. And since one of the recurring themes in this hour has been people are putting the wrong things in their recycling, I'm still taken aback. Everything from bowling balls to lawnmowers, Christmas lights. Jenna Jambeck, what's your final sort of set of advice for what people should be recycling or definitely keeping out of the recycling so we can be good stewards of what's coming out of our own homes every day?
Well, I do think there's a lot of responsibility on the, or put on the sort of the citizen, and it's challenging. And actually born out of our research, one of my former students and alumni here is running a company called Can I Recycle This?, which is using social media platforms and artificial intelligence to answer this question sort of immediately based upon somebody's location. And so I think tools like that, making it really easy to get that answer, that's what we need to do. And then people also need to ask that question.
Mm. And David Biederman, do you have a final thought on that?
Sure. People should be putting material into their blue bins clean, dry, and loose. Never put the material into a plastic bag. Plastic bags are terrible for curbside recycling. But the callers who said that we need to reduce consumption are absolutely right. It's reduce, reuse, recycle. We've gotten lazy and we do recycling not so well. We need to reduce the amount of waste that we generate. And then finally, we need to look to the federal government for assistance. This is a national problem. It requires national solutions.
Well, David Biederman, Executive Director of the Solid Waste Association of North America, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Jenna Jambeck, professor in the University of Georgia's College of Engineering, an expert in waste and recycling, and co-creator of the Marine Debris Tracker. Jenna Jambeck, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And a couple last thoughts from listeners on Twitter. Jackie Eaton says, we need to add refuse to the three R's. E.F. Sweetman says, it dodges the key element of this enormous issue. Why do we use so much plastic? What are the plastic makers doing to stop the environmental destruction? Go to the source, E.F. Sweetman says. It's a plastic disaster. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.